The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thinking about earth care, I love the word care because it has so many connotations. One is to have care for something is to be concerned for its well-being. And it doesn't have to be limited to animate beings. We care for objects. We care for, you know, all kinds of things that we care for that are inanimate, that are maybe important for us in various ways. And to care for it is to be concerned for its well-being, to keep it in a way that it makes it sustainable and honored or respected a lot, kept clean, perhaps, depending on what it is. Keep something healthy or functioning. Caring for your car just means, you know, making sure that it runs well enough, I suppose. But some people care for their car, and it means waxing it every Sunday. You know, there's all kinds of things that people do. But care also implies not only a concern, but also actions, like cleaning the car or helping a neighbor, caring for a neighbor. But those actions and that care can be overlapped with the idea of compassion and love and kindness, where to offer care is to offer some of the most important ways that human beings, care for each other, connect to each other, support each other. We have child care. When my first son first went to preschool, I was one of those parents who was a little bit in tears about so appreciative of the preschool teachers caring for my son, and it was such a profound thing for me to feel someone else's care. And in some ways, the same way I felt somewhat similar last week, I suppose it was, or 2 weeks ago, where my mother died, and I accompanied her with the mortician who came to put her on the gurney and wrap her up and accompany her out to the van that we're going to take her away. And then thinking about where she was going, the funeral home, and for cremation. And I felt kind of tenderly moved. I was entrusting her to their care. And it meant something for me it meant like something profound for me that they were kind of caring for her in her last times in this body, kind of. And so this idea of care is very touching, and paternal care, which kind of is necessary for children to grow up well, is to feel paternal care, and that children growing up who don't feel the care of their parents, they grow up kind of askew. Something goes a little bit dysfunctional there. And I like the word care because commonly we talk about parental love. But there are parents who love their kids who don't care for them, or the care is a little bit askew. Just to limit it just to love kind of maybe is not the full equation to care. And so earth care, what are all the things that implies, and what is the earth? And what does it mean to care for it? And one of the things that it means for me is this very profound Buddhist principle for us to support what supports us. That whatever supports us is something for us to support in return. And whether it's our community, our people around us, or it's the natural world, it's the earth itself, the whole earth with all its people, somehow we have this very profound connection that where's the boundaries of what supports us as individuals? Where's the boundaries for what supports us as a community? You know, does it, you know, Redwood City has boundaries. Is that it? You know, that's all that's my community that supports me, and I'm not going to care about anybody else? And obviously not, right? There's the support circles of support extend outward and outward and outward. And these days it's pretty clear it extends to the whole world. So much of what we consume and receive and are influenced by can come from anywhere in this planet. So we're supported by this wide range. And so do we support it in return? And this idea of mutual support, what does that look like and why would we do it? Why would we care about the earth? Why would we care about, you know, natural resources? Why would we care what happens to the species in this planet, whether they go extinct or not? And you can give an argument that, it's very logical and can lay out the data and, you know, and really lay out why in a practical way. But that's not the specialty of Buddhism. So when I was new to practice, actually, then it just occurred to me before I started practicing, when I went to college, first months in college, we had this communal, bathroom we shared in the dorm. And I had a friend who would brush her teeth next to mine sometimes, and she did a really strange thing. She turned the faucet off when she wasn't using the water for brushing her teeth. She'd wet her toothbrush, turn the water off, brush her teeth, turn it on, get it wet again, back and forth, but she's always turning it off. And I'm like, what's that about? Why would someone turn off the water? That was mystifying to me. And then at some point she said, I'm conserving water. And, why would someone do that? And then when I first got interested in Buddhism, I went to a Zen center in Los Angeles. And the way that they did the evening schedule, you did a period of meditation, sitting meditation, a short period of walking meditation, and then another sitting meditation, and then a Dharma talk. And the walking meditation was all done together in a kind of a circle, and it's really slow. So you're walking behind someone, being really attentive and present. And there was someone in black robes, Zen robes, maybe a priest or monk or something, that was in front of me. And we sit on these black, like these here, they're Zen things that we have here. These black mats that I'm sitting on, if it's a meditation mats. So in Zen, they all have the black mats, and they were lined up in the room. And one of them, as we were going around, was slightly askew. And so there's a priest or this practitioner in front of me. She kind of matter-of-factly bent down and straightened it out. And then again, why did she do that? Why bother? Why would you straighten something out? I was mystified by this strange behavior. So I was strange, right? So you have to appreciate that maybe. Who knows what influences me growing up? But anyway, so so why did you do that? And then just a little while later, there was a senior practitioner when I was at the San Francisco Zen Center, who was receiving a kind of an admin role, received a fundraising letter from a neighborhood nonprofit that was doing work in the neighborhood for some kind of good work. I'm not sure what it was. And he showed me the letter. I don't know why he showed it to me. Oh, yeah, and then he asked me, what do you think? How much should I give? And I was kind of mystified. Give? Why? What's this about? And it didn't compute quite. And so, and then he said, I'll send $50, he said. And I said, what? Why? So, it feels very strange to even say this, that I'd be so mystified by these strange, simple things. And then I was practicing during a retreat at a Zen retreat, and I was having tea in a little bit formal way with a visiting Japanese monk sitting next to me. And it was time the people came around and collected the teacups when you finished having tea. And before he was going to hand his teacup back to the people taking it, he bowed to the teacup. Why would you bow to the teacup? Like that, there's nothing. Why would you? But it's a teacup. It's inanimate. It's just a thing, Why would you bow to a teacup? So that kind of, how clueless I was at some point in life. And And so, but what Buddhism reveals as you practice it is how deeply we're connected, how deeply we're part of and intimately related to teacups and water and the neighborhood community and even in some way we're actually related, we're almost like kin to the way the mat is down there on the floor, and you know, straightening it out is not straightening out the mat, it's maybe straightening out oneself. You know, what's going on there? What is this connection we have? So then you come to the kind of Buddhist teaching, and we have this very important word, dharma. And it often represents the Buddha's teaching, the dharma. But dharma is also the word in the ancient language which is the best match for the English word nature. I don't know of any other word that it fits as well, and it's used that way sometimes. You go in dictionaries, you see that it's one of the definitions of it. It has a lot of has other meanings as well, but that's one of its important meanings. And if you make it into that the word dharma into an abstract noun, dhammata, then translators will translate it as natural. It's natural. It's part of the natural order of things. It's a natural thing. So dharma, but what is dharma besides it maybe being nature? It's kind of abstract. There's a very famous little slogan from the early tradition that to see the dharma, you see the dharma in how things are interrelated. And when you see how things are interrelated, you see the dharma. And the way this is discussed in a particular way, the interrelatedness is the way in which things exist, dependent on other things, depending on the support of other things. We rest on things. And then when they get a little bit more sophisticated, they recognize that some things co-arise. They arise together, mutually supporting each other. And so if dharma is nature, where is nature? Is nature found in the trees outside, in the squirrels? Is it found in the weather? Is it found in the whole shebang of this whole, you know, everything that's kind of born from natural conditions? What is nature? And one very, maybe very profound way of understanding it that kind of turns things around for us in a, I think, a profound way, is that nature is not found in the tree or the squirrel, in things, or in you even, exactly. Nature is found in the relationship between things, the relatedness, how things exist in kinship with each other. And that relationship is a little bit invisible. You know, it's like you can't touch it. You know, you can't, you know, I can hit the bell. But is the bell nature? Is my fingernail that hits the bell nature? For people who like to focus on the world of things, I'm here and things are out there, then it makes sense that out there is nature. Just beyond the edges of the city is the natural world, some people will say. And I used to say that as well. And it was quite a surprise for me when I spent 3 years practicing in Tassajara Zen Monastery, which is in the wilderness, really in the wilderness, in Los Padres National Wilderness. It's there. Inland from Santa Cruz, Big Sur, the coast of Big Sur. And after almost 3 years living there, I went back to live in San Francisco. And one of the big surprises was after that experience of deep monastic practice was I started seeing nature everywhere. I saw it in the asphalt in the city and the cars of San Francisco. I saw those, that too is part of nature. But it was still a little bit outside of myself. And what I didn't see then was that the reason I could see it as nature had to do with the way that I was relating to cars and everything had changed. And rationally, I explained it not that way. I explained it that everything comes out of nature. Everything's co-arising together. And we can't really point to anything which is not nature. That's kind of how I explained it to myself. But I think what was really happening is what the way in which I was relating, the relationship that I was forming or was being formed, because a relationship is not something that only comes from me. It's mutual. It happens together. And that relationship is where maybe what nature is, at least in this Buddhist idea, where Dharma is called nature. And so what if that relationship is kind of so important to pay attention to, what's the nature of that relationship? And that's where Dharma, that's when in Buddhism, we come up with the idea of karma. Karma is our contribution to that relationship. The actions, the things we do, things we say, even the things we think and believe, has an influence on that relationship that we are in with everything, with the water that we get from our sink, with the local neighborhood, with the teacups, whatever it might be. That relationship is influenced. We contribute to the nature of that relationship. And so in a simple way, if we hate something or hate someone, that relationship has qualities of that hate in it. I've known people who have a predisposition to being angry, and they get angry at all kinds of things. They're upset with the world's not doing the right thing. And I could watch and see how the world responds to those people. People don't like it. Of course people don't like those people, because they're coming at them, you know, expecting and mistrusting them and suspicious, already kind of like thinking that you're wrong. And so then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so that relationship gets formed in a certain way that's shared. Doesn't have to be, but... And I've watched and seen how people who are kind or supportive or friendly disarm people who are angry or hostile. Sometimes, you know, you see that you bring something to the relationship and it helps shape the relationship. Of course, there's no guarantee just because you're kind that it's going to change it, but it can make a huge difference. I was once saved from violent attacks. I don't know how serious it would have been, by my friend who was so amazingly both kind, friendly, and funny. And that he disarmed the people who wanted to attack. And I didn't have that ability, but that was quite impressive to see. So what do we bring? So karma has to do with our contribution to that relationship. And it gets even more interesting. Is the karma that we bring, the attitudes, the approach we have to what we do, what we contribute, is also the dharma of ourselves, meaning it's also the relationship we have with ourselves. You can't hate without it affecting you. You can't be kind without it affecting you. In Buddhism, they have dramatic language for this, that hate is a poison. Guess who is poisoning? It's poisoning you. And it can poison the world, but this is where it really has the biggest poison. Craving and greed is considered a poison. So it's dramatic language. Maybe some of you won't like it that this way, but what it's pointing to is this way in which the karma, what we contribute to the relationship, can actually has an effect on us as well. So if we live with greed and craving, then it comes back and bites us. It also creates a skewed relationship out in the world. But it's invisible, right? So who cares? You know, it's not obvious. So, you know, probably most people don't think that they're rampant consumerists, but we have a society as a whole that is. And that does it to a lot of people all over the world now don't do it without much thought. There's a lot of conceit, there's a lot of idea of me, and I want things for myself, there's acquisitionness, acquisitional kind of quality of I want this, and then when I don't want it anymore, then I throw it away. Someone else is going to take care of it. I mean, I pay the trash people to take it away, so not my responsibility. And there's a kind of ignorance there. There's a kind of a forfeiting of responsibility. Maybe it's okay in some kind of abstract way, do that way, but it's a lost opportunity. The most precious thing we have, the most valuable thing we have, is the contribution we make to how we relate to this earth, to this world, to others. That's the real treasure. And you can feel it, I hope, if you meditate enough in meditation, that's the case. I've been meditating now for about 50 years. So, you know, I have a little bit of experience around it. But the main thing, reason I say it, is that I still, to this day, literally this day when I meditated this morning, is I'm going around the kitchen and getting ready to meditate and doing stuff. And I didn't get too much trouble, just the time I woke up and sat down. But if I sat down to meditate, it was so good to sit down, and I noticed that my mind had already begun spinning a little bit, where there was a kind of compelling feeling, like it's all, you know, like I'm on the right track, like this has to be done, I should do this, and this is important. And it was a little bit kind of self-centered in my little universe. And then I sat down to meditate, and that just kind of dissolved. And what was left was so much better. This is real. This felt like, this is, like I felt free, I felt warm, I felt centered, I felt at peace, at ease, in a way that I felt all healthy, everything was present. And in contrast, what I saw was I was deluded for those few minutes in the kitchen in a certain kind of way, ignorant. I was being swept away by the things I had to think about and do and all this kind of stuff. And it was enough, and I didn't see how I was losing my ease, losing being connected in some deep way. It's that easy. And imagine if someone never has a way of disconnecting from that. They believe their minds. They believe the momentum. They believe the desires, the wishes, the conceits. It's about me and what has to happen. It's radical to shift that, move out of that, and come into a place where we have a chance to relate from a place of health, from a place of being centered and easeful and being at peace. And so when we talk about earth care, it can come across as duty, as obligation. We have a responsibility to do something, and let's go out there and fight the good cause, and let's kind of shame everybody else into doing it too. Something like that can happen occasionally. But I think from a Buddhist point of view, my hope is that we would tirelessly care for the world, for the earth. Tirelessly. But not because it's an obligation, but because it's the most natural thing to do in the kind of relationship that is the healthiest, most meaningful, most inspiring way to live in this world. Anything short of that probably doesn't come from this natural place where we're creating a healthy relatedness, where we honor the relationship, we respect it, we understand it, where we have this cup of tea, and I don't think the cup maybe itself responds to the monk who bowed to it, but what a radically different relationship that monk has to the cup of tea than someone who just tosses it in the trash can because they don't want to bother cleaning it. No one will know. There's so many teacups at the Zen Center, so, you know, I don't have time. It's a very different relationship. I heard this beautiful story yesterday of a Native American, a Lakota man who's a professor, I think of environmental studies in somewhere. And So he told my friend the story of having an undergraduate class and maybe environmental studies. And the first day of class, the students come and sit down, and he stands in front of the class and he says, I have an unusual request. If you kind of please do it, you know, might, you know, I have an unusual request, but if you would be so be anyway, kind, will you something? Can you, I know you just sat down. Can you get up and go outside and touch a tree? And the people looked at each other and like, apparently they weren't so enthusiastic. What's this going on? We came to learn or something. But they went out and touched the tree. And then they came back, sat down. And he said, well, I know you touched the tree. I know this is really a strange request, but I'm going to ask you to go do it again. But however, this time, before you touch the tree, wait until the tree gives you permission to be touched. And so they went out and did it, and when they came back into the class, the students were in a whole different state of mind. They were kind of quiet, reverential, they were kind of ready to learn, they were, they had, something had softened in them. And their relationship was to learn, it was, had shifted from that simple exercise. He had them enter into a relationship with the trees. And whether trees can really give us permission is maybe less important, that something transpires in the relationship between the trees and you, that you feel that there's an invitation, a permission, a request. When I was an undergraduate, I took botany, and I was so amazed by the beautiful circles written on the chalkboard of the oxygen carbon dioxide kind of cycles that go on with the plants. And, you know, they make the oxygen that we need, and we make the carbon dioxide that they need partly. You know, so this wonderful cycle. And then I went out into this courtyard in Davis, California, where they have this majestic old oak trees in the courtyard of the auditorium. And I just was stood in the middle of the courtyard, stunned by the trees and wondering, where do I end and where do the trees begin? Where do the trees end and where do I begin? I could give away one of my kidneys, my hand, all kinds of parts of my body I don't really have to have to live. But I need those trees to be alive. Where am I? Who am I? What's going on here? I just stood there in silence, kind of just in awe of it all. That was a very different way of relating to the trees. Then, you know, that looks like firewood. Huh? I think, you know, I need to be warm, so I'm going to take my axe and chop it down. We are supported by what supports us. No, I say, what supports us is what we want to support. If we don't support what supports us, we destroy our support. And that's what we're seeing. We've seen down through history, down through the centuries, we've seen this. And I grew up, in places in the world. I just went visiting, and I lived right on the Adriatic coast for a while, and in a city in Italy called Trieste, right on the border with what was then Yugoslavia. And we used to go down the coast of Yugoslavia, beautiful islands, stark and stony. They used to be covered with soil and trees. But they were denuded, and all the water rushed away because they harvested all the trees to build Rome, and things like that. We've seen down through the ages that human beings, have overextended their agriculture, their woodcutting, their farming, all kinds of things, and destroyed the place of support. So it's not a new thing for us to be doing it in our generation, but there are places in the world where that's happening. And perhaps it's what's changed is the scale of it. And so we come back to Buddhism, what we have to offer for this. We have this beautiful principle that we want to live attuned to our relationship, our relatedness, our relationships, because that's the heart of where nature is found. And we contribute to that. To the degree to which we have agency, we're a contributor to that relationship, and we want to be careful that we contribute something which is healthy, something that really is healthy for us as individuals, as a community, and healthy for the world itself, for the natural world itself. That's represented by this slogan, that to support what supports us. We support what supports us. That would be the ideal. And so here we have this Earth Care Day, which is celebrating this possibility, celebrating that the dual meaning of earth care could also mean that we're recognizing that earth cares for us. That Earth Care Day is recognizing how we're cared for, how we're supported. And it can mean the week that we consider and reflect on caring for the earth. And so in saying all this, to summarize now, at the heart of it, of this as Buddhist practice, is caring for the attitude, the motivation, the contribution that we offer to that relationship. And if we care for that, then I think we'll find how to care for others, for the world, for people and everything in a way that doesn't drain us, doesn't oppress us, but rather we'll learn how to do it in a way that feels natural. It feels like this is what we were built to do. This is how humans were made to be this way. Something that's very hard to appreciate unless you have some way of connecting to the deeper sources within us, the places of real health that goes on inside. Or connecting to the tree that we ask permission to touch. The strawberry plant, we wait to pick the strawberry until it feels we recognize that the plant says, it's okay now. Why would you do that? Maybe because there's a shift, there's a change, there's a receptivity, there's an openness, there's a caring, there's a attentiveness in those questions that brings forth something deep within ourselves that we then contribute to our kinship with all things. So, Earth Care Week. So in a few minutes, we'll have this have a chance to have tea and talk with each other and meet with the Earth Care Committee. But before we do, we ended a little early. I'd like to just start doing what we used to do before the pandemic, is to, for those of you who are comfortable with this, simply turn to someone who's near you and say hello and introduce yourself. There's a lot of people here who have been here for the first time today, maybe. And also, if you care for it, you might want to say... Oh, Hillary wants to say something?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just have an announcement. I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's just something to get on the calendar, so I wanted to let anybody know who has kids. The Dharma Rocks program is starting back up again in person next Sunday. So any kids from... 3rd through 6th grade, or even if you have a 2nd grader, you're welcome to bring them. If you have any questions, you can ask me during the tea.
So for those, especially for people online, Hillary said that we're starting up the what's called Dharma Rocks, the children's program for 3rd grade to 6th grade?
Yes.
And next Sunday we'll meet here in person for the first time since the pandemic. Anyway, if you turn to someone and say hello, introduce, and then if you, especially someone you don't know, and then if you want to say something about was there anything meaningful in this talk or what you liked or didn't like. But, you know, the idea of being in a relationship, right there you have a chance. So, thank you. Please.